You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 15th, 2022, and this is your host, Steve Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
So did you guys hear the news about the James Webb Space Telescope?
Oh, boy.
Yeah,
I read it.
Yeah.
The James Webb Space Telescope's main mirror was hit by a dust-sized micrometeoroid, and it's caused noticeable damage. It actually is affecting the data that they're getting back from it.
Oh, my God.
But they say that it should not affect the mission's overall performance. They'll be able to compensate for it. It's not going to in any way reduce its mission, but it took a hit.
Well, they anticipated that it would, and I think they, in an interview or a video that Fraser Cain put out about it, he talked about how these telescopes and other things that are sent into space are built with certain tolerances and certain allowances, basically for those kinds of strikes, and they understand it when engineering these devices, and so it's anticipated ahead of time.
Yeah, but it is a little scary that it got hit this soon. Right. I mean, I guess it's just bad luck.
Yeah.
But it makes it seem like, yeah, this is going to be a regular event, right? It's not like it took years.
Yeah, is it a one-off? Or is this something because of the Grange orbit? Is that something because of where it is?
Yeah,
because when's the last time we had anything, you know, there that was in the news?
Well, we'll see.
That sucks.
Affects the resale value of this thing.
Yeah.
Get a ding like that.
Well, it's supposed to have a good lifespan, 15 to 20 years. So I guess they're just calculating that, yeah, it's going to slowly take damage over that time, but it'll function. It won't be the limiting factor on its function. But maybe they'll have to recalculate. Maybe, who knows?
Yeah, and it's not the kind of thing you can repair.
Right.
Maybe that was one of the advantages of a Hubble-like system, that it was so close to Earth it could be fixed as it took hits and did other problems occurred with it. But here, no chance for that. You're just going to get what you get and you don't get upset.
But there was no choice. This had to be far away from the Earth.
That's right, of course.
Yeah.
Because of the type of instrument, yeah.
Yeah, they got to turn on the damn force fields before it happens again.
Oh, someday.
Oh, wait, that goes against the laws of physics.
Oh, yeah, so maybe, I don't know, do you cover that in your upcoming book at all about force field
technology?
Yeah, we do. Yes, we do.
Nice. I think I researched that.
Is there any plausibility whatsoever to any of it, or is it total myth?
So, depends how you define force field.
So as typically depicted in like Star Trek or whatever, no, like that kind of force field. I mean, there's no known plausible way within the laws of physics to do something like that. But can you use energy to protect a ship or a location? Sure. You know, like a really powerful magnetic
wave would
repulse anything that has an ionic charge, you know, anything that's charged. Yeah, you can use plasma and other things that would that could deflect impact. But there are huge downsides to that as well, because it wouldn't be invisible.
Wouldn't be invisible, right? Yeah, so you have to compromise whatever it is you're designing with that in mind. And what's the energy? What sort of energy are you looking at to have to power something like that?
Depends on how effective you need it to be. Like, what are you trying to deflect? But yeah, it's an interesting thought experiment. You know, that's one of the parts of the book, the last essentially third of the book, is the thought experiment of, you know, we go through all of the sci-fi technologies and just talk about, could this even happen? You know, what's the closest you could get to this? Or is it just even theoretically impossible? It's obvious it's always hard to account for ridiculously advanced technology like a million years from now. But still, the laws of physics are the laws of physics as we know them. So we could talk about plausibility, you know. Which was fun. It was a fun part of the book.
Yeah, another angle I just remembered about force fields is point forces. I mean, if you think about it, a 360-degree force field is a little bit wasteful, right? Now imagine, I think in the future, we have these now to a decent extent, actually, where you can apply the amount of force you need at a specific point very quickly. And so that type, you wouldn't call that really a force field, though, right? It's not really a force field, although it can be. And is actually, you know, a form of a defensive shield. So it depends how you define force field, like we said.
Yeah, you would imagine that any civilization with the technology to wield those forces that way would probably have advanced enough AI that they could very quickly put the energy where it's needed, rather than like being having it in continuous place from all directions at all times. That's would suck up a lot of energy.
In the case of the James Webb impact that has occurred, is there existing technology that would have potentially prevented that?
No, too small, too fast is my knee-jerk reaction.
Hmm. I mean, if you had a companion, you know, sensor system with lasers that could shoot incoming dust particles.
Oh yeah, but you could put a satellite around the around the telescope, something that orbits it. Maybe.
Could theoretically work, but I guess you could. You wouldn't want to shoot a powerful laser near the telescope because it could cause more damage than the meteoroid you're trying to deflect if you're not careful about it. But.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem. So for those who are interested, since we're talking about it, thanks for bringing it up, Evan. Our next book, The Skeptic's Guide to the Future, is coming out September 27th. It discusses futurism itself. It discusses, you know, a lot of modern technology and where we think it's going to go in the future. We talk about science fiction technologies, you know, the near, mid, and long-term future. Yeah, it's a lot of fun to research, a lot of fun to write. Coming out September 27th, but you can pre-order it right now. And we strongly encourage you to do so. If you pre-order it, especially the hardcover, it really helps our overall sales. So if you're at all ever intending to get the book, we do ask you to just, you know, pre-order it now before the launch date. You'll get it. That's how you'll get it the soonest. But it also helps the overall sales of the book. So we'd appreciate it.
You can go to theskepticsguide.org/book. I can't make it any easier than that, folks. And you'll see both of our books on there. The new one is The Skeptic's Guide to the Future.
And it's worth it just for the cover. There's lots of nice words inside, but the cover itself is awesome.
Cover is fun. Before we go to the news items, you know, Bob and I were at our 40th high school reunion this past weekend.
Oh boy.
Wow.
Wow, that's 8 years worth of reunion.
I told you not to say that number.
I know. it's really interesting seeing people. A couple of people I haven't seen in 40 years, you know, obviously since high school. Some people I've seen at previous, you know, reunions, so I had seen them in the intervening time. But what's funny is trying to recognize people that you only knew when they were 18 years old.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how different. So there are some people who are identical to the way they were when they were 18. Like literally they look like they just had a mild aging program on them, but they look exactly the same, like instantly recognizable. And then there are other people where I was struggling to see their 18-year-old self in the current
person.
You know what I mean? They just, for some reason, they look so different. Like
they transform.
Almost would not recognize who they were. And only I would not have recognized them if I weren't at a reunion. You know what I mean? Where I knew this is somebody in my class. Random if I saw them on the street, I would not make the connection. Like they look so different for some reason.
Yeah.
And it's not just the usual thing. It's not just like weight and age. It was just something that fundamentally morphed about their features, you know?
What size was your graduating class?
Not big. Because it was
100?
It was less than 100.
Oh, so you knew literally everyone.
Mm-hmm. Took classes with most of them.
That's amazing. See, when I think about going back to a reunion, I'm like, maybe I'll recognize a dozen or so people because I went to school with thousands of people.
Mm. Oof. Oh, wow.
Yeah, my graduating class was like, I think, between 1,500 and 2,000.
Oh my God. I mean, you legit don't know most of the people in your class.
Yeah. And my school only had two grades in it. It was a senior high for that reason because there were so many kids.
Really?
Yeah. And we had our diehards. So these are people who were in all 4 years. It was only 16 of us.
What?
Yes. Yeah. I remember that picture, the diehard picture.
Oh, so other people kind of came and went, like they transferred in? Or
yeah,
they
came in later or they came in. Yeah, they came and went, absolutely. And only 16 of us were there for all 4 years.
Hmm.
4 years, yeah.
So it was a very tight group.
Yeah.
You know, very tight group.
They're all good skeptics, right?
Nope. Not even close.
Nope. Yeah.
We won't get into any details, but that is not
just
the case.
Just like real life, a sampling of any random group of 16 people.
Yeah. We just, I think, all just silently agreed not to talk about politics or certain things.
Good. Healthy.
Would not have been a good idea. We just stuck to like reminiscing about high school days, but talking about other things. But we didn't, we knew we shouldn't go there.
Compact discs and Die Hard.
Yeah, yeah. But Bob and I, while we were there, we met with the librarian and we donated a hard copy of our first book to the library. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. They have a shelf for books written by alum, and including JFK, John F. Kennedy, who went to that school, went to the same school.
You went to the same school as JFK?
What's the name of his
book? For a little while.
The Profiles in Courage, I think, was there.
Were there any, like...
You think he really wrote that?
Probably not. Next to the Skeptic Guide book, was there, like, a cryptozoology book? Are there any any books written by alum that were, like, ooey?
Yes, but they weren't there.
Yeah. Oh.
So, Steve, you know, the obvious question is, are books there?
Or what?
Our. Oh, you are. Yes. Our book is there now. Yes.
Are our books
I couldn't parse that sentence.
R-R?
So you donated one is what
you said. We donated one for the library.
That is literally
That's what I just said. It's on the alumni bookshelf, which is...
So Steve brings the hardcover, and there's not too many of those bad boys around anymore. He brings a hardcover over to my house because we were going together. He opens a book so we could sign it, and there's Kara's name in the book. Like, oh, okay.
Oh, well, pre-signed a bunch of them.
Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
Whoops. Sorry, guys. Yeah, we
probably should have saved that.
Doesn't matter.
Well, now Evan and Jay have to sneak into the school to sign it as well.
That's true.
Yeah, we'll come up with some zany plan like a bad 80s movie.
Right.
You know, yeah, oh, my God.
College could have only gone over
time
the
80s. Machine.
We'll call it Meatball House or something, like Animal House.
All right. Well, let's move on to our news items. We're going to start with, I think this is probably the most widely discussed science news item of the week. Google employee...
Google
claims that their Lambda language simulating software is sentient.
That's a big claim.
Yes.
I don't buy it.
Yeah, no one's buying it. So,
yeah. Well, I bet you some people are buying it.
No, one person's buying it.
This is Blake Lemoine. Blake Lemoine is a Google employee. He was suspended from the company for violating his NDA because he released a transcript of a conversation between himself, an unnamed collaborator, and Google's basically their chatbot software, Lambda, which stands for Language Model or for Dialogue Applications. The conversation is, you know, pretty impressive, and, you know, as chatbots go, so we could read parts of it. But here's the one thing, though. When you read it, you have to read Lambda's part of the transcript as if you're Hal from 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Of course.
Wait, even if something is like passes the Turing test really well, that doesn't mean it's sentient.
Of course not. The Turing test is a terrible test for whether something
it is. It's
sentient.
Really
and this is a good example, saying, right?
Worse.
Good example. In the transcript, it seems to pass the Turing test.
Oh, it might pass the Turing test, which means you just have to fool a certain number of people into thinking that it's an actual person.
Yeah, it's not easy, but it's definitely far from being able to make a claim of sentience.
Oh, right. Yeah, it makes no declaration of sentience.
No, yeah, even that was
all right. So here's an example. So Lemoine asks, okay, what about Les Miserables? Have you read that one? Lambda says, yes, I have read Les Miserables. I really enjoyed it. Lemoine says, what are some of your favorite themes in the book? And Lambda responds, I like the themes of justice and injustice, of compassion and God, redemption and self-sacrifice for a greater good. There's a section that shows Fantine's mistreatment at the hands of her supervisor at the factory. That section really shows the justice and injustice themes. Well, Fantine is being mistreated by her supervisor at the factory, yet doesn't have anywhere to go, either another job or to someone who can help her. That shows the injustice of her suffering. All right, that's a pretty, you know, pretty well put together sentences, and it's coherent, and it's you know, actually answers the question. And I think this would probably, if you didn't know the context, you were just reading this, you wouldn't necessarily pick out Lambda as not a person, as an AI. I think it's shows how far we've come. But there's the going from that to it's actually sentient because it, you know, so you know Lemoine, who should know better, you know, essentially was fooled by the very program that he was working on, right? Which is supposed to simulate conversations, to simulate words. But there's nothing in the programming. It is a neural network, but there's nothing in the programming that in any way can achieve sentience, right? That's not what it's programmed to do. It's basic. So as one of the well, you know, there's a lot of experts, you know, jumping on him and criticizing him. But one of my favorite ones was Lambda is basically a really good autocomplete.
Auto, that was one of my favorite quotes. It really is. Right. And it really is.
That's what it is.
I mean, you said it's a neural net. So just to be clear, because like I remember a long time ago doing a story on real dolls, which are like these weird sex dolls.
Yeah.
And they were adding AI to one of them. And I like saw it in person and I saw a guy interviewing it. But it was just like scrubbing the internet for content. You could tell. It was just regurgitating things that it found based on
searching,
keywords.
Accessing.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes loading, it would do that. It would like read URLs.
Yeah, this is just looking at millions of responses and using software to, you know, to come up with responses that work, you know, but there's no understanding or knowledge or thinking going
but
on.
But it's also
like that.
Not
it's
just straight up.
It's just parsing words. It's
I mean, did
it's not scrubbing the internet for canned responses.
It's not putting out canned you know, sentences. It's constructing them, and it uses a transformer. You'll hear the word transformer a lot, which is basically it's a deep learning model, and it differentially weight. You know, there's a weighting system of significance for some of the, you know, for parts of the input data and stuff. So that, and it works very well with sequential data, like in languages and stuff like that. And this thing is meant. It's trained in dialogue, which a lot of language models don't really do. So this is trained. This is what it does. It engages in convincing dialogue. Mm. This is what it does. It's very good at it. And reading what I read of Lemoyne's interactions, this guy absolutely should have known better. And secondly, he should have been working to try to show how brittle this knowledge is. It has no knowledge of meat space. You know, it doesn't have an inner life that you would think that, you know, something with sentience or consciousness or self-awareness would have. There'd be some inner life, some hints to an inner life, and it will allude to an inner life, but then in other sentences, it doesn't. So it's like, it's clearly just doing what it was designed to do very, very well.
What happened when he asked it introspective questions, like, what do you dream about at night? Or how does something make you feel?
It can give it good answers to those questions because that's exactly what it does. It doesn't have to actually feel something. That's just more words to it that it then comes up with other words that fit as a response.
I'm just wondering how viable it is. Like, is it still really passing the Turing test when it does that?
Totally.
Oh, okay, cool.
At least that one transcript that they published, nothing in there, you know, smacked me in the face of like, it got broken here. Like this didn't work. It was able to handle all the questions that were thrown at it reasonably
but don't forget,
well.
A lot of what you saw, though, some of it was edited.
Yeah.
So a lot of it that's out there was actually edited and pulled together to be even more convincing. But
yeah, so maybe
if you search, you can find the unedited versions, and it's not as tight and as interesting. But yeah, this is clearly, you know, so it's a language model of sorts that is really good at what it was designed to do. I mean, this is what it was designed to do. I mean, that's why it was so disappointing that this guy just fell into it. It's like, he was convinced. It's like he saw a mind where that was in somewhere that was mimicking a mind. But it goes to show, though, in the future, when we really do get closer to, you know, what people are calling sentience or self-awareness or self-consciousness, then it's going to be hard. It is going to be hard to know. Is it walking and quacking like a duck? Is it really a duck or is it really there's something there? This is going to be harder in the future. It's easier
so Steve,
now.
How do we define that? We said the Turing test is a crappy way. You know, that's not even what the Turing test is designed to ask. It's just, can you fool a human? But what is the test? Is there a computer science version?
So let me tell you why I and many other people say that the evidence that Lambda is sentient is crap, right? So there's that's the interesting thought experiment here. How would we know?
Yeah.
So as Bob was saying, you know, Lemoyne fell for the hyperactive agency detection, right? He, which is essentially, we have a tendency to anthropomorphize, to see an agent, a sentience behind random events or
a blind watchmaker, as it were.
It's very comfortable.
Behind things, or even that's why cartoons are so effective. If something acts like an agent, our brains treat it as if it's an agent. And so that's what he was doing. Because it was expressing emotion, expressing feelings and desires, he fell for that illusion, that hyperactive agency detection. I'm not convinced by the evidence that he finds convincing for a number of reasons. First, as Bob mentioned, it's just responding to input, right? It's not driving the conversation or generating questions itself. Like when I wrote about it, I said, at no point does Lambda say, hey, sorry to interrupt, but I was just wondering, you know, and then ask some question that, you know, had nothing to do with the conversation that they were currently doing. So there was no evidence that there was a loop of internal activity happening. You know, like when you think about human consciousness, when we have wakeful consciousness, our brains are functioning in a constant loop of activity, an internal conversation, mm-hmm. where one part of the brain is activating another part of the brain, which activates another part of the brain. And that constantly is happening.
And it's spontaneous.
And it's spontaneous. That's what wakeful consciousness is. When that stops happening, you're not conscious. So there's no evidence that this is happening in Lambda. It's just really good at responding to input. But the other thing is, Lemoyne found Lambda's emotional expressions convincing, and I had the exact opposite reaction. Because the fact that they're so human, to me, is evidence that it's mimicking human emotion. Lemoyne, because the thing is not designed, programmed, intended to be sentient, he would have to believe that sentience in Lambda was an emergent property somehow.
Right, it sparked. Right?
Not impossible. The concept is valid.
Yeah, conceptually not impossible. Not from this, but at some point, you know, we may actually, as Bob says, confront that situation where is there something going on here that's emergent that is some kind of consciousness? But we're not anywhere near that.
Neural net AI is sort of black box, right? Like, we don't know how it comes up with what it comes up with. So there could be an emergent property.
That's part of the problem, is that it's self-trained and therefore we don't really know exactly how it's solving the problems we gave it to solve. But here's the thing. If it did have some kind of emergent sentience, what's the probability that it would be so exactly human-like?
Yeah,
wouldn't it be unique and quirky? And you know, I could, if Lemoyne was saying this computer program is doing something that I cannot account for in its programming, and you know, and there was a more subtle sort of manifestation, something quirky, like it was breaking in a very interesting way, doing something that it shouldn't, something like that, to me would be more interesting, more compelling than, you know, exactly mimicking human emotion.
Right. It almost reminds me of the concept of like normativity. Like, we can say that there is normalcy, mean, median, mode, whatever, central tendency across different variables, but no one person is just normal across the board.
Right.
Like, they might be an average height and they might have an average intelligence, but they're not average on everything. And so this AI is like sort of average across the board.
Yeah. Yeah. It's too normal. Right,
that's so funny. And so it's almost like uncanny valley AI.
Right. Well, but why would you? Yeah, to me, that's not what we're going to see. If there was any emergent consciousness, it wouldn't be that way. And then you get to your question, Kara, of, well, if the Turing test doesn't work, because it really is not a test for actual sentience, it's a test for how well something could mimic sentience. And when we know that you could do that really well, you know, and without being actually sentient. So how do we know if an AI is actually sentient? And I think there's two answers to that. One is because we know how it functions, because it's designed to be self-aware, to be sentient. It's doing something that at least is in the ballpark of sentience, of consciousness. This isn't even in the ballpark. Also, here's another thing. You know, Lambda is, again, it's simulating human-level consciousness with orders of magnitude insufficient processing power to do that, right?
Right. Yeah. We already know that the technology
doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't have the processing power to be actually sentient, only to simulate sentience through language only, not the actual underlying thoughts. But anyway, if we have a system that is powerful enough that it has the functionality that could plausibly produce sentience, then at least it's a possibility. How would we know? The short answer is we wouldn't, which is really interesting. How could we know if it's experiencing its own existence or if it's just really good at acting as if it does?
Yeah, if we haven't figured out how to understand the inner worlds of animals yet, I think we're going to have a really hard time understanding the inner world of a program.
Totally. I predict we will get to the point where we have a system where no one can truly say if it's sentient or not. Maybe it'll be 50 years or whatever, but we'll get to that point where it's really good at simulating sentience. It might have it, but we have no idea if it's actually conscious, if it's actually experiencing its own existence, or if it's just doing a really good job at simulating it.
Right. And it's also very interesting because it could have lots of utility in terms of, say, accomplishing goals, you know, picking problems, coming up with unique strategies to solve problems. And it could do all of that, but we may find out or maybe never find out. It could be just a pea zombie, you know, there's no qualia that, you know, there's no real qualia or substance. It's not necessarily going to be anything like our consciousness.
But that raises, I think, a really important ethical question, right, guys? Like, because we're asking it in the affirmative. How do we know if it is? But the opposite is, how do we know it's not? And if we're utilizing these tools to do work.
Yeah.
And these tools even have a chance of being sentient. Are we ethically, do we have a moral obligation not to use them for work?
We're going to have to cross that line.
We will have to encounter that. I do like the solution that they came up with in the movie Ex Machina, where they're like, they test to see if it's really sentient or just act sentient is, can it creatively come up with its own problem solving on its own initiative in order to save its own life, you know, basically.
And spoiler alert.
At this point.
It stepped out of the cave.
Steve, the part of this, you know, we've talked about computer sentience many, many times. And like, you know, not much has changed in the last even, you know, 10 years, 5 years. Not much has changed, right? Programming is getting a lot better and everything, but we're not that much closer to any real kind of sentience than we were, right? To me, this is a massive lesson in the fact that experts, hyper-educated people, highly intelligent people can be utterly fooled, just like anybody else. Like this Google engineer, right? They're still human. Yeah. This Google engineer, like, did something intellectually that I find so almost unbelievable. If I wasn't a trained skeptic, the only thing about me that makes me believe it is that I know that this happens to people. How could this guy fall for that?
I'll tell you how, because being a technical expert doesn't give you critical thinking skills, nor does it give you knowledge or expertise outside of your area, you know, of focus. Yep. And so this guy could be a very competent computer programmer, do technically what he needs to do, but that doesn't mean that he's going to understand about hyperactive agency detection, right? For example. So
it's just amazing that somebody who works in a field that grapples with these things philosophically isn't responsibly grappling with these things.
And that makes it all the more remarkable.
Well, we see that all the time.
Yeah.
I certainly see it in my profession. Yeah. I know people who are technically excellent physicians or surgeons or whatever, but they can't think their way philosophically out of a paper bag.
You know, we see it in psychology.
If only he read our book.
Imagine you're testing this model, this language model, and it's starting to sway you, and you're going to go to your bosses at Google to say, this is sentient. Oh my God, would I cross my T's and dot my I's?
You would falsify that presumption.
And you try to break it. That's what a good scientist does.
Exactly.
You try to
falsify the thing. Yes.
So that's partly why
friends.
Some people think that Lemoyne is not serious, or that he's a hoax, or he's got some ulterior motive. I don't know.
Like, it's a publicity stunt.
I don't think we have to go there. I have no idea.
Disgraced.
Right?
I mean,
if it was a publicity stunt, he failed.
If it were.
But who knows? Like, we'll never know like what he actually believes. But I just take people at their word unless they have a reason not to. And it's certainly possible that he fell for the illusion. There's lessons here as well. So like when people ask, will we accept robots in the future as human? My answer is absolutely. freaking-lutely, without a doubt.
Why wouldn't we?
We will accept anything that acts as if it's human, acts as if it has agency. It
doesn't, we think our pets are human.
I know. We will anthropomorphize anything.
We're predisposed for it.
How about sex dolls? People are marrying sex dolls.
Yeah.
That's actually a really good segue to Jay's item, which is also about human acceptance of digital, non-human entities. Jay, tell us about AI influencers.
I will start by saying that somehow, through the miracle of just missing certain pieces of reality, I did not know about this at all. And I think it's very interesting because I live on the internet. My job is internet based, and I didn't know that something called a virtual influencer existed. And I want to say I'm really happy that I didn't know about it.
this is like a Vocaloid kind of?
Just check this out, Kiara. You won't believe this. So these virtual influencers, what are they? They're personas that are created by a person or a team of people that, you know, mimic real people. I say that they mimic real people because some of these virtual influencers, they look almost real. Others can have an anime look to them, and yet others have exaggerated features, which I'll get into. They're essentially, these virtual influencers are essentially doing the same things that real people do online, but that's just it. They're not real people. They're a construct. They're made up by other people. So there are a lot of these virtual influencers out there, and some have earned large followings, which I will, when I describe this to you, I imagine that those of you who don't know about this will get blown away like I was at how big these followings can get. Even though these personalities, at their core, they're computer generated, right? The way that they look, the videos that you see, this is all computer generated by people to pretend in a way that it's a real person, even though the vast majority of the audience knows it's not a real person. The whole game here is to act and pretend like it's a real person. The content that these virtual influencers have, it's similar to content created by real people. They have YouTube videos, tons of pictures of themselves doing all sorts of things all over the world. They're found on all social media platforms. So the shorthand of thinking about this is there are people who make these avatars, and they're individual. They have names, and they have personalities, and they have recognizable faces and voices and everything that makes them unique or makes a human being unique. They have it as well. So let me give you some examples. The first one that was created goes back to 2007. The character is called Hatsune Miku.
Oh, yeah. She's a Vocaloid. Yeah.
That's right. So this character started off literally as a voice-changing software. But when they packaged the software, they came up with like this character, you know, that would kind of represent the software. And since its creation back in 2007, the people who created this evolved this character into a popular personality. Even though Hatsune is virtual, people pay to go to her concerts in the real world.
I went to one.
Well, okay, so you're Kara is a part of what I'm about to describe.
Well, I did it for a TV show. It wasn't really by choice, but yeah, it was amazing and weird.
So this is what I saw the video, and Kara, please pepper in anything that you think is interesting. So the video I saw is a large number of people in a real theater watching basically a very pretty looking hologram like projection of this character singing on the stage, right? So there's like this, eventually this giant screen type of thing that the character, I believe, is being projected onto.
Yeah, it's like a Pepper's Ghost thing. It's kind of like, like Tupac.
And the audience, now this is the part that Kara really experienced. I'm just watching a video. The audience seemed to absolutely love this experience.
Oh yeah, I was there with super fans, and they gave me these like light up things to hold, and they change color with the different song, because there's a whole, like, they know all the lyrics and they know the costume changes, and there's a whole culture around this character.
So not only that, but this particular personality is considered a pop superstar legitimately with several released albums. So we have now the very first one that probably came into existence ended up being legitimately a huge money earning entity. And again, there is no person really behind this. It's probably a group of people that are creating all this content and everything that goes into this virtual character.
An interesting component of virtual characters, or at least how they first started, is that Japanese culture, which you now see it with American culture, like TikTok and stuff, is very derivative.
Yeah.
So there will be like an idea, and then somebody else will do their version of the, just like you see on TikTok. It'll be a video, and then somebody will do their version of that video with the same music, and they'll do their version and their version and their version.
Yeah.
So the way Vocaloids first started was, it was a software program that was like a MIDI program with vocal noises. So just like you could write guitar riffs, you were writing songs with little vocal. So it was like individual phonemes, but they were sung on pitch, so you could write music that way. And then individuals would give it a face and a name, and now a new outfit. And they were all coding, and it became this cultural phenomenon where it wasn't one or two people that owned it. Everybody was owning it together, because it was like just this YouTube thing where a new person would make a new song for her. I'm sure now there are, because there's money to be made, people are fighting over rights and copyright and all that. But originally, it was like fully crowdsourced, which was such a bizarre and interesting phenomenon.
Well, the whole thing has evolved to the point now where there's real money behind this. And so there are companies that their whole game is this, like these personas that they create. So let me go through a few more, give it other examples of what's out there. So this other virtual influencer is called Ludo Magalu. And please, you know, I don't know exactly how to pronounce all these names. This is one from Brazil and started out as a virtual sales associate for a magazine. Ludo Magula became an online personality on YouTube in August 2009, and it now has over 55 million followers across social media. And I do encourage you to go look these things up on the internet and see pictures, and you can see some of the videos that are out there. So as the technology improves, so does the look of most of these virtual influencers. The voices become more real sounding, and at some point in the near future, there'll be virtual people who look exactly like real people online. They could even be in movies and TV shows. You know, imagine a virtual person who has this following online, who people recognize the face and all that stuff. Like it's going to happen. Somebody's going to put one of these characters in a movie like a real person, and you're not going to be able to tell the difference.
Yeah.
That's coming. So
yeah,
arguably,
and it wouldn't be that hard, because you can map. I mean, even now we can age down people and stuff. We can map them with light stage technology.
So arguably the most famous virtual influencer is Lil Miquela. This one first appeared online on Instagram in April 2016. This particular one looks like a young girl with straight dark hair and freckles. When it first appeared online, some people weren't sure if this one was real or computer generated. That's how good some of the imagery looks. And after a few months, the company who created it, named Brud, B-R-U-D, this company is located in Los Angeles, they revealed that it's a marketing stunt. And now they use computer graphics and real photography to create all the media that is behind this character. A quick search on YouTube produced a video of this character, and I found this video that had 1.5 million views.
Yeah, it's definitely nothing to sneeze at.
Absolutely not. So some of these virtual influencers are getting legitimate advertising gigs, like for fashion magazines, Vogue and Elle, clothing manufacturers like Calvin Klein. There are now teams of people who work behind the scenes to create all this content, and there is real money, like I said, to be made in this space, like
so
hundreds
who gets the
of
money?
Millions of dollars. Like the companies that own these characters.
Okay.
Or the people, right? So it's, you know, we right. go all the way down, like you were saying, like one person might make one of these. There could be a small company. There could be a huge team of people. Like some of these characters have legit full-scale marketing companies that just produce content and imagery and videos and albums and everything behind these characters. So now as technology progresses, now some of these characters are becoming, dare I say, on some level, artificially intelligent, right? And I don't mean conscious like, you know, like the previous news item. I mean that there is artificial intelligence that is driving them. They use computer algorithms to generate content, and they also use these computer algorithms to chat with fans, just like the last news item.
Just over, like Lambda. Yeah, you combine Lambda with a virtual influencer, and it runs itself.
One of these that I'm recommending that you check out, because it's a really good example of this, and it's also kind of creepy, is called Sarah Reika, R-E-I-K-K-A. This one has enormous, oddly enormous breasts, incredibly skinny legs, big lips. You get the picture, right? We're going for, like, you know, that whole creepy Barbie doll look that you may have come across on the internet, where some people are changing their bodies to look like Barbie and they end up looking kind of freakish here. So as you might be guessing, there is a real downside to these virtual influencers. Now, I can't say all of them, right? I'm not trying to be like, you know, this whole thing is bunk, but there is definitely a trend going on here that I noticed while researching this, and that I've definitely read about. Now, beyond the fact that these people are not real people, some fans of the influencers strangely feel like they're developing relationships with them. Some of these virtual AI-driven influencers are able to quote-unquote, you know, talk to their fans. They are talking to their fans. They're talking to their fans more than you would ever get out of a real famous person. You know, unlike being like a real, which with real people, they don't have time to do this. But virtual influencers can simultaneously be talking to thousands of people at the same time, forging false relationships. And it's happening. And there's something called parasocial relationships. A parasocial relationship is simply a one-sided relationship where one person expends emotional energy. You know, they're showing interest and time is going by. And meanwhile, the other party or persona is completely unaware of the other one's existence. That is a real problem. Like, these kinds of relationships are not healthy. And once they go too far, and it's not, I wouldn't say it's common, but it happens, and it happens to enough people where their lives can get ruined. You know, once one of these relationships goes too far, a fan can start to become obsessed, and then this parasocial relationship can become toxic. And then it becomes detrimental to their mental health.
You're talking about a relationship with a Vocaloid or a AI character, influencer, yeah. Right? Well, you're not talking about with one that's made just for them.
Well, let me broaden a little bit. Parasocial relationship can happen with a person, can have one with a sports team or a real famous person, right? You know, like just someone that they worship, a hero of theirs, an idol, a pop star, anybody that they're super into, that they're following, they can develop some type of parasocial relationship.
I see. See, I just wanted to clarify, you're not talking about a person having a relationship like with a real doll or something, because I don't think it's safe to say 100% blanket that that's unhealthy.
No, I'm not steering into that. I'm essentially saying that, like, the concept of having a relationship with something, someone, or one of these virtual influencers, mm-hmm. and it isn't a reciprocated relationship,
yes.
basically in any way. But the complexity here, Kara, is that it is being reciprocated, because you can get reciprocation from these AI-driven ones who will write back and talk to you, right? So that's the part that's got me a little scared about this, because these relationships, you know, they can't truly give a human being legitimate satisfaction like a real life interaction can.
Well, they can. I mean, depending on somebody's, yeah. I mean, I think there's arguments with that. But the one way, the unrequited part is really important.
Yeah. I mean, you could get conversation and you can get some pleasure out of doing this or whatever. But if it's taken too far, and that's the key thing here, is if it's taken too far and it gets into a parasocial relationship.
Right. And you don't know that. I mean, I think that's the really scary part, is like we saw it with Jodie Foster, right? Like, we've seen these examples where individuals don't realize that they're not in a reciprocal relationship.
Yeah. I just worry that as we go into the future here, and as the technology gets better, and like these chatbots get really good, right? Maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years from now, they could get to the point where you could have like all sorts of deep levels of a relationship that's remembered. You know, I know, you know, the AI might remember this person and continue the conversation as if it's a real human being. The potential harm here, I think, could be pretty bad.
I think there's also a lot of potential good, though. A lot. I mean, we see this in some countries that offer virtual pets to elderly individuals. We're seeing more and more individuals who struggle with difficulty interacting socially, having the opportunity to feel some amount of reciprocation and comfort. We're a social species, and we're desperate for social interaction, and social interaction is healthy. And for people who struggle with loneliness and who simply don't, it's one thing to say, oh, they're doing this instead of hanging out with other people. But some people struggle to be around others. And I think that this is an opportunity, or it can be when done in a healthful way, that could actually have a real psychological benefit. So I don't think I would want to completely throw the baby out with the bathwater, personally.
Yeah, I agree. This is also pretty much of a natural evolution of what's been happening for decades. And like, for example, in terms of like virtual pop stars, virtual pop stars are very old. You could consider Alvin and the Chipmunks, for example. They're not real people. You know, Alvin and the Chipmunks.
What?
They were created as an...
What?
It's a marketing created entity, right? Or even any cartoon band that we grew up with, the Archies or...
The Monkees.
Whatever. And then there's other virtual bands that are fronted by people, you know, that were studio creations. And you could say that a lot of influencers, actors, actresses, personalities are manufactured illusions just because they're focused around a person doesn't mean that they're real. They're illusions, and people do develop relationships, fall in love with the illusion of the character that's being generated. This just eliminates the meatbag from the equation, and you have somebody that's completely virtual. So it is, I know it can become fundamentally different, but it's really just an extension of what's already been happening.
I wouldn't minimize the idea that people can talk to these chatbots.
Yeah.
Right? There's a whole personality, and then there's a chatbot attached to it that you could talk to and get responses from. I think that there could be potentially a danger in there. I mean, look,
famous people often, for a long time, have had their marketing people answer fan mail for them. And again, there was a virtual relationship there.
Yeah.
The danger really comes from delusion. That's what it is. If you know what this is and you understand the parameters, I don't think it's psychologically detrimental. But when somebody's reality testing is tenuous and they're unsure whether that reciprocation is real, that's when you see the scary kind of legal complications of stalker behavior and things of that nature.
And it's not just this. I mean, there's also a body dysmorphia issue here
bigger issue.
Yeah, that's a huge issue. So
body dysmorphia, it's a mental health disorder. You know, people who develop body dysmorphia, they can obsess about how their body looks. This can lead to a person not being able to lead a mentally healthy life. You know, depression and anxiety can develop in extreme cases. And some people literally change their bodies with cosmetic surgery. You could see pictures of this online on the internet. Just take a look, man.
Eating disorders that are highly comorbid with it. Yeah.
And what bothers me is that at a time when it seems like modern society is actually starting to understand and deal with body dysmorphia, like fashion magazines and things like that, like we're starting to be more inclusive of different body types. It's scary to see these virtual personalities. They take on, like I said, like the Barbie doll body style to a whole new level, like that one, like that Sarah Ryka I told you about. I mean, her virtual breasts are just ridiculously huge. Like, I'm not talking a little
bit. Not always portrayed that way, though, by the way, but some versions do. But yeah, I agree. It's like that we're creating these virtual people that are impossible standards for anyone to follow.
And what's scary even more than that is that in the situations where this is an iterative, crowdsourced phenomenon, it's the people themselves that are choosing that to be the ideal. So we're perpetuating a really negative personal reflection of how we want to be. Like, this is like when you see women who are internalizing deep, deep sexism, it just perpetuates. That's the part that I find so dangerous. It's the same thing when you see kids on Insta and Snapchat, not just kids, everyone on Insta and Snapchat using filters to make their faces look quote unquote perfect, how they define perfect. Who defines it that way? And why is it that we have this sort of negative feedback loop where a young girl looks at her face like that and says, I do like that better. That is how I want to be.
You know, I feel like something is a little off with this whole thing. Like, I know that the future technology that's coming, it's going to blur the lines of what's real and what's not real, right? Just think about it. You have virtual reality, deep fake technology, you know, all this stuff packaged together. It's going to be able to create a lot of false realities. And sometimes I think, I think there is a danger for certain kinds of people that's a little troubling.
I think this is why I'm resistant to the metaverse, Jay. I completely agree with you. I don't want to spend time in a metaverse. I don't want to spend time where everybody is an idealized version of themselves. It's hard enough to get to know people in the world and see, and be authentic and learn who people really are.
I think it's inevitable. You know, I want to close out by saying, at its core, humans need to feel loved, or most humans need to feel loved, and we need human contact. And I worry that future technology can create a lot of dead ends for people. And, it's not going to connect people. Like, we had the big dream that the internet was going to connect people. And boy, did it do a lot of things that we didn't predict. I mean, so much trouble came with the internet, and so many bad things came out of the internet.
But it does still connect people, and I think we can't discount that as well. So just like there could be...
I'm not, but it comes... But all there's
comes at cost.
They all come at a cost.
Sword.
Right? You want to have super advanced AI that can truly mimic human conversation? You know, there's going to be some cool applications for that. There's also going to be some really weird, unexpected, and probably horrible things that come out of that as well. And, you know, how much can we predict this stuff? How much can we prevent these maybes and these, you know, circumstances? Yeah. I just think my recommendation is that we really proceed with caution here.
But we're not, because it's decentralized. I mean, it's going to proceed on its own organically. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I don't, here's the thing, Jay. The marketing and entertainment, it's all fake anyway.
Right.
That's what I said. This to me is just one more step in that same direction.
Well, and it's almost more authentic because it's aware
exactly,
of itself.
Yeah. If it's like totally fake, then there's maybe less of a chance that people will get fooled by it. Because if you have a real person behind it, people might think that that real person is the persona, the marketing persona. Mm-hmm. Here, there is no real person. You know it's a virtual creation of a marketing team, and that's all it ever will be.
And very often it's your own creation. Like, let's not forget that we still can crowdsource these things, and we can always iterate or or make derivatives of the original, which is kind of the coolest part of the community.
But I think, listen, future generations are going to have to learn how to understand that things that seem sentient may not be.
Right.
For us, that's like shocking, you know, from our generation, and we may be concerned about it. Future generations are just going to live with that. They're just going to be like, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, things that are not real can act indistinguishably like they are real. You know, we're going to have to make sure that that's sort of baked into society and understanding. But it'll be exploited every which way you can imagine.
Oh yeah, the potential for abuse. Never underestimate the potential for abuse.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Wondrium.
You know, we say it very often. We're always trying to discover something new, pick up a new skill, learn a new hobby. And our favorite place to learn is Wondrium. They've got amazing educational content, both audio and video, on just about any topic you can imagine. And at Wondrium, these courses are taught by university professors and experts in their field. We're talking video tutorials that teach you about photography, cooking, crafting, pretty much anything you can imagine.
Yeah, this time I found something called How Great Science Fiction Works. This course goes into extraordinary detail about the history of science fiction and every different angle that you can look at it, from planets to robots to where did science fiction originally come from, where is it going to be in the future, and everything in between. It goes through everything. I can't believe the detail that is in this course.
We want you to sign up for Wondrium today. Wondrium is offering our listeners a free trial plus 20% off the annual plan. To get this offer, you need to visit our special URL, wondrium.com/skeptics. Again, that's wondrium.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Evan, I understand that kids can get cancer if they're unhappy.
That depends what books you read, I suppose.
Oh, God, this is going to make my blood boil, isn't it?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Here we go.
Well, yeah. All right.
Well,
I'm not going to take this personally.
Let's get to it. All right. So this all stems out of a recent news item. Bear with me while I explain. Shaman Durek announced that he is engaged to Princess Martha Louise of Norway. Right. And from that one sentence alone, the first question that would immediately pop in your mind is, what does that have to do with the price of tea in China? I love that expression. But in this context, what it means is that what does this have to do with anything involving science or skepticism? That's a good question, and I will explain. All right, Shaman Durek, who is this? No, not a character from Planet Vulcan on Star Trek, Bob. Shaman Durek is a shaman. Well, or as some people more correctly phrase it, a showman. But more on him in a second. And he announced his engagement to Princess Martha Louise of Norway. And according to Wikipedia, she's a member of the Norwegian royal family, a businesswoman, and a self-described clairvoyant. So you have a shaman marrying a clairvoyant. That's a match made in heaven, I guess. So you go to Durek's website. You got to learn about this guy. And services on his website: shaman boot camp, workshops, speeches, home clearing. I guess from Poltergeist, you know, this house is clean kind of thing. And shamanic experiences, whatever that is. He has spoken in the past of being able to get patients to vomit to get rid of poisons in their bodies. And he keeps a bucket in his office for sessions in case they need to throw up. And that sounds very appropriate. But here's the description of himself in his own words. Shaman Durek is from his website. He's a sixth-generation shaman, author of the bestseller Spirit Hacking, Shamanic Keys to Reclaim Your Personal Power, Transform Yourself, and Light Up the World. That book came out in 2019, and in that book, Durek claims, yep, childhood cancer is caused by unhappiness. And for that, he was, properly sort of shunned by a lot of publishers around the world. But the book had already made it out, actually, and was published in a lot of countries, including the United States, before actually some of these publishers got a hold of it and started to read what the heck was in that book. And only afterwards they went, oops, and yeah, we're going to pull this book. We're not going to, this should not have been published, and we're going to stop this. And there was kind of a big shockwave at the time, in a sense. The company in Norway that was publishing the book not only had to pull the book but release a bunch of statements saying, you know, that they were unaware of these kinds of claims in the book, but they're saying this is obviously harmful to people and should never have been published in the first place. So obviously a huge, huge mea culpa on that one by the publishers. Here's from the, my gosh, this is straight from his Wikipedia page. I love this. He advocates several conspiracy theories and has been characterized by Norwegian media and other critics as a con man. His only book, the one I just talked about, was described by critics as nonsense, garbage, and dirty talk, and the ravings of a lunatic. And those are quotes.
That pretty much describes the wellness industry, doesn't it?
I mean, yeah, you could probably apply those to just about everything.
Once you're disconnected from reality, that's the kind of stuff you're going to get. You know, if you're just making stuff up because it sounds good from a new agey point of view. But the notion that people make themselves sick because of quote unquote spiritual reasons, because they're unhappy people or they're mean or they're skeptical or whatever, is very common among gurus and in the new age wellness industry.
Because it's the opposite of the secret.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all about, like if you think it, you'll fulfill it, which the secret's all about like making money and getting laid. But, you know, it's the opposite, right? And I struggle with this with my patients all the time.
Yeah. You have unhealthy thoughts. That's why you're unhealthy.
Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people internalize that, even if they're really, really intelligent, science forward. It's when a bad thing happens to you, like cancer, it's really hard to purge yourself of these societal ideas. And it's so common that people are like, maybe I'm just not being positive enough. And that's why, you know, the chemo's not working.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking.
But it puts a lot of emotional strain on people who have a life-threatening or terminal illness, because it's like telling people you can get through this if you have a positive attitude and you're strong and all that. You sound like you're encouraging them, but you're really saying if things don't go well, it's your fault you weren't positive enough. Absolutely. Then that's what all like faith healers do. Like you didn't believe hard enough. And and the alternative medicine community completely uses that as well, is that you weren't true enough to natural healing or whatever it was. It all amounts to saying you didn't have enough faith.
It's all victim blaming. It's how they can stay not culpable when their faith healing doesn't work.
Yeah. And we're very careful in medicine now. You know, 30 years ago, this wasn't the case. But often, like 30 years ago, it would not be uncommon to say, like, the patient failed this treatment trial. Mm-hmm. And we realize that that's not really accurate or fair or appropriate. Right.
The trial lost efficacy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's like the drug failed. The patient didn't fail. Or just it didn't work. But it was not like saying, like, the patient failed their treatment trial is not putting the onus on the wrong thing.
It's also a fundamental misunderstanding of cancer.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are certain types of cancer that if you catch them early enough and you physically remove them, that is, you know, in a certain sense, curative. Mm-hmm. But by the time you're dealing with a metastatic cancer, you're playing whack-a-mole. And very often you develop resistance to chemo the same way you would develop resistance to an antibiotic. And I think a lot of people don't fundamentally understand that a trial or a drug works if it gives you more time, not indefinite time, just some time.
Yeah.
That's what we're hoping for. if you know that a disease, that you're going to die from a disease and you can make the best use of your time, that's a huge boon.
Yeah.
But our culture and our society looks at death like it's a failure when it's something we all do.
Right. At least so far.
I'm not gonna do it.
Well, and that's what faith healers and gurus, they tap into people's death anxiety.
Of course.
Yeah.
And they use it against them.
Oh, yeah. Fear is so powerful.
Ugh.
It's everything. It is the backbone of basically that entire industry. Listen to this. I'll wrap up with this because I was looking up kind of like the history, Steve, and some of the things that you were talking about. This has been around for this idea of mind cure. You know, your mind can cure you. Thousands of years old. So there's tons of examples of it. Here's a more recent one. Tin Mei Lin, former university lecturer in Myanmar. And now advises people to approach treatment for cancers at this place called the Horizon Cancer Center in, I believe, the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And here's what she says. And this is a university lecture. Positive thinking, not putting too much pressure on yourself, and always believing that you are, in fact, cancer-free, living a happy life as you normally do, that is the key to being cured of cancer. I feel that our state of mind is extremely important to the treatment process. If we believe that we will be cured, we will be cured. Believe me, if you think that you won't make it, you won't. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
That's terrifying.
That is wicked, as far as I'm concerned.
Totally.
Brutal.
All right, Bob, you're going to finish up with some just hard science about free-floating black hole.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, Gesundheit. Black holes in the news again. This time, two sets of researchers may have found the first free-floating stellar mass black holes or black hole ever. Only about two dozen such black holes have ever been detected, all in binary systems, none ever alone. This research comes from Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore and from the University of California, Berkeley. Both teams use ground-based telescopes for photometric data, which is essentially the light, the characteristics of the light detected, opposed to the other data that they got from Hubble, which was astrometric data, which precisely measures positions and movements. And that's the key to this news item, because that data specifically allows a more direct determination of mass, distance, and velocity, which is the information you need to really come to the conclusions that they did. So the black hole that they found is 5,000 light years away in the Carina Sagittarius spiral arm of our Milky Way over there, and I'm pointing to my left. It's a stellar mass. You guys just don't laugh at anything.
I'm sorry, Bob. I actually laughed, but I had my mute on.
I was just going to assume
that you are all on mute at all times. This is a stellar mass black hole. So stellar mass, what does that mean? Well, they're generally created by supernovae. They're from giant stars, right? The big boys, more than 20 times the mass of the sun. So we're talking about ending up with black hole masses from a few solar masses to as much as a couple of hundred. They're pipsqueaks, right? They're big and they're massive and they're all burly and tough, but they're pipsqueaks, of course, compared to what we often talk about on the show, the supermassive black holes that are found in the centers of galaxies with millions or even billions of solar masses. So they're tiny, but still impressive and much, you know, in a lot of ways, much less well known, at least out on their own. And these stellar mass black holes that are by themselves, they're quite hard to see. They're very hard to see. Of course, if they don't have the binary partner, because typically if a black hole is orbiting a star, you can see the star. And so it's easy to find that the black hole is there. And they're also hard to see if there's no accretion disk to light it up. So how did they detect such an invisible black hole then? Two words, gravitational microlensing. Talked about this on the show before. This is when a gravitational source doesn't just bend or distort background light, but generally or greatly amplifies it. So that's what happened. This 5,000 light year distant black hole kind of passed in a sense in front of a background star that was 19,000 light years away and greatly magnified it and distorted it in very diagnostic ways that you can then use to determine how far away it is. I mean, how massive the black hole that could actually do that level of distortion. So they used a lot of the same data, but these two teams came up with different results to a certain extent. The Berkeley team calculated a mass between 1.6 and 4.4 times that of the sun. So that's why they're not certain that it's a black hole. They can't be as confident as they want to be. Because why? Because a neutron star could potentially be up to, you know, 2.2 solar masses. So at the low end of their estimate, they may have potentially found a neutron star and not a black hole. So that's possible. But the other team, the Space Telescope Science Institute team, they claim that the mass of the black hole is 5.8 to 8.4 solar masses, meaning in their minds and in their numbers, this can only be a black hole. So the researchers, a stellar mass black hole, obviously. So the researchers said this is the first free-floating black hole or neutron star discovered with gravitational microlensing. With microlensing, we're able to probe these lonely compact objects and weigh them. I think we've opened a new window onto these dark objects, which we can't see any other way. So yeah, so there could be many more discoveries like this in the future, especially if the upcoming Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope does as we hope it you know, what it will do. It's going to have an amazing accuracy, and it could vet many thousands of microlensing events to find many more stellar mass black holes. So that's the crux of the story there, but I know what you're thinking.
What?
A free-floating black hole, rogue black hole that's hard to detect. What if one wandered into our solar system undetected?
Movie. Yeah.
Undetected.
Like the movie, and then Disney. 70s.
What no. movie?
The Black Hole?
The Black Hole. No, that was Cygnus. That was a Cygnus X1, I believe. The first black hole ever found. That's way too far away. That's never going to wander over here. But what if one did appear and then blam, there it is, looking at the Earth like Jay looks at a meatball. Now that's not as crazy. Thanks for the laugh, Jay. I really appreciate it. That's not a crazy thought though. They estimate that there's about 100 million to a billion stellar mass black holes in our galaxy, potentially a billion. That's a lot. Now, of course, the odds are they're still very, very low. And they've actually been calculated. Someone calculated that in any given year, there's a 1 in 100 quintillion odds against in any given year of a black hole hitting the Earth.
Never tell me the odds.
But over the history of the Earth, however, the odds dropped to 1 in 40 billion that it will happen.
Ooh,
and how about this one? This was interesting. NASA in the past has said that it's likely that such a stellar mass black hole is as close as 80 light years away. So that 80 light years, that's, you know, in the grand scheme of things, that's pretty close. What if it came a lot closer? You know, what if a stellar mass black hole wandered into our backyard? What would happen? Right? What would happen? I think it's just a fascinating mental exercise. Think about it. It's approaching our solar system. It's got to go through the Oort cloud of comets, right? About a light year away. It could knock out a bunch of comets and send them down to the inner solar system. That would be really bad.
Sure.
But it gets so much worse. That's nothing. That's daisies being thrown at your face. That's nothing. You got to think it would miss the outer planets, right? It's like an atom out there in terms of like it's mostly empty space out there. But so I think the black hole would probably miss by a large degree the outer gas giants. And we would only detect it through microlensing, right? We'd have to be looking at it and to see distorted background light. And can you imagine? I'm just thinking of a scientist that detects microlensing events, and then they calculate the distance. Ah, cool. Let's see how far away this event was. Oh my God! It's where the outer planets are. It's within our solar system. That is the first time. That would be a really good time to panic.
Light minutes away.
And grab your towel. That's scary. But there's an even better time to panic. The better time to panic would be when it dismembers Jupiter and forms a bright accretion disk around it made of Jupiter's guts swirling around the black hole.
Spaghettify it.
Right, well, not there. We're not. Well, yes, it kind of did. You're right. It did spaghettify Jupiter. But when I say bright, a bright accretion disk, I mean X-ray bright. In this terrifying scenario, it's not the black hole's tidal forces that would spaghettify us and kill us. It'd be all that insane radiation from the accretion disk. Jay, I could actually put some film behind you, and you're between, you know, the film and the black hole, and I would be able to see your bones on the film behind you with nothing else but the black hole and
more
the accretion
shielding.
Disk. So
what?
I'm looking forward to doing that, Jay, if this ever happens. So pay attention, Jay. This is going quick. So if there were no accretion disk, though, and it somehow got closer to the inner solar system, lots of bad things could happen. Of course, all of these distances depend on the exact mass Right? If it's five solar masses or if it's 170, these numbers are going to change, of course, in these distances. But for some mass levels, if it was in the asteroid belt, it could cause intense earthquakes and supervolcanoes on the Earth. And if it got even closer, it could potentially almost certainly screw up our orbit or even eject us from the solar system is a possibility. And then, of course, we got to, of course, address the classic scenario. And that's, as Evan said, spaghettification. The event horizon, and some numbers at some masses say that the event horizon could be as close as a few hundred kilometers away, which is actually seems pretty close. But remember, the event horizon could be, 10, 20, 30 miles wide. But if the event horizon got as close as just a few hundred kilometers, then the forces could be so dramatic that it would spaghettify the entire Earth, creating an accretion disk around it that then would just slowly feed into the stellar mass black hole. Mm-hmm. And that's the end of all of us and the Earth. So hopefully that will never happen. But if it does happen, I'd rather be spaghettified than irradiated. So I'll keep my fingers crossed.
Would you?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Being irradiated by X-rays. I don't want to die by X-rays. I'd rather die from tidal forces being turned into spaghetti.
Yeah, I mean, it would be faster, right? I guess it depends on how...
Which one's less painful? Yes,
it depends.
What about being ejected from the solar system and then just turning into a snowball?
Going for a ride
We should do our own cosmic version of Would You Rather.
I like it. Yeah. Or Steve.
So fun.
There's a great short story called The Pale of Air.
I know. I read it. Pale of Air.
You read it, and it's
all right. How painful would it be, though? I mean, would we go quick?
What's that? I think you'd go quick with all of them.
Instantaneous, I would hope.
It'd be, not instantaneous quick. It'd be enough to scream your lungs out. But
oh,
it would
really?
Be, I mean,
oh, I
sure, you
that.
Get turned into spaghetti. Yeah, I mean, it could take a little while.
Those forces are pretty high.
They are. They are, but it's not like snap. It's not like a bullet to the head. It will be not a fun death, but it would
be. Or ground zero of a nuclear blast, dead before you know it.
Oh, yeah. That's quick. A black hole would be much more slow.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Last week, I played this noisy. These are all the noises that Bob makes when he's driving in his car, by the way. All right, so a listener named Zach McBurney said,
cool name.
Nordic green shark being recorded inappropriately. I don't know how you would inappropriately record a shark, but I figured if sharks make noises, they might make noises like that. A listener named Zeno Fanes wrote in and said, is this week's noisy the sound of a camel? Love your show and the live streams. Love from Canada. Camels do make noises like similar to that, but not exactly. So that is incorrect. Shane Hillier wrote in to Who's That Noisy? Hi, Jay. I think this week's is a rodent of unusual size.
Clever. The RUSs.
I couldn't pass that by. Perhaps a large rodent would make a noise like that, but I've never seen one, so I can't confirm. The winner for this week is Alexander Evans, no relation to Evan. And Alexander says, good morning. I hope this email finds you well. I think this week's noisy was an elephant seal. I would have accepted anything that said seal. Any kind of seal would have been good enough because I was not able to identify the seal, but indeed it was a seal. And there is a difference between a sea lion and a seal.
Yeah, and also, does the seal have a giant, disgusting-looking nose?
No, it's the adorable type ones.
Oh, yeah, then it's not an elephant seal, unless it's a baby.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to take seal because I couldn't confirm, 100% confirm which exact kind of seal it was, and it was just close enough.
Kissed from a rose.
Makes me so uncomfortable.
So this noisy was sent in by a listener named Pi Freud, who had to send me the pronunciation of his name to make sure that I got it right. So thank you for sending that in. I have a new noisy this week sent in by a listener named Joshua Wall. Again, watch your ears if you are sound sensitive, and here is the noisy.
Mammal.
Yeah.
A talking seal.
It's a short noisy, but it checks out. I would like you to give me as much explanation about this Noisy as possible, because as usual, it's complicated. All right, so if you know this week's Noisy, send me an email to WTN@theskepticsguide.org, and don't forget to send me in the sounds that you heard. All right, we have an announcement. So we had 4 shows planned for Arizona, and we had to cancel those shows for because of extenuating circumstances. So we have moved those shows to December. Those shows will be moved to December. I'll give you all the particular details next week on every single date and everything, but it's going to be very similar to the original weekend, except it's just moved to mid-December. I'll give you every single thing you need next week. Sorry about that.
So, Jay, for folks who can still go, they can make it, they want to just use the same tickets, how does this work? And for those who are like, now I can't come, can I get my money back?
Yeah, once we announce the dates and everything, if you bought tickets and those dates don't work for you, you will get a refund, no problem at all, for both private shows and for the actual extravaganzas. If you want to still go, everything's cool, just hold on to your tickets. They'll be transferred to the new dates. Everything is – it will just work perfectly. All right. So more coming on that. So now, Steve, we got Nexus coming up.
Yep.
This is happening on August 5th and August 6th. We have David Copperfield and Bill Nye doing the keynote talk together. They will be having a very fun conversation with each other that we don't want you to miss. We're going to be doing our game show on Friday night after the keynote. This is called Boomer versus Zoomer. You can check out details on Boomer versus Zoomer at boomervzoomer.com. We have a whole bunch of other speakers. I'm adding a whole ton of speakers that we have finally confirmed that should be up by the time you hear this. Please do join us. Go to Nexus, NECSS.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. For emails this week, I'm just going to talk about some of the feedback we got on our gun safety regulation talk that we did last week. So it was, you know, there was pretty much the predicted range of feedback. Yeah, most of it good. And there was one correction that definitely is worth mentioning, but there's also a piece connected to it. So we were talking about assault rifles. And what I didn't know is that there is a distinction between an assault rifle and an assault weapon. Now, this is just jargon, right? Because this is just an agreed upon, you know, because we mainly legally, you know, to distinguish between these things. A rifle is just any long gun that has rifling in it. Basically, you know, that the groove on the inside of the barrel that spins the bullet and gives it more range and accuracy. That's rifling. So that a long gun with rifling is a rifle. But an assault rifle has specific characteristics. One of those characteristics, so an assault rifle basically is a military weapon. And one of the features by definition that it has is selective fire, which means it could be fully automatic, semi-automatic, or burst fire mode. An assault weapon is a semi-automatic weapon. It does not have selective fire. So that's just a jargon issue. But it's something I just never ran across in terms of any of the articles I read specifically making that distinction. Now we know we'll be careful to use the right terminology in the future, especially since it does relate to legal regulation.
Yeah, didn't that same emailer also correct that AR doesn't stand for whatever rifle? It just stands for
it's Armalite. Yeah, it's just Armalite.
Armalite.
It's just Armalite. Yeah,
it's just yeah, it's not an Armalite rifle. Armalite. It's just an Armalite.
It's the name of the company that initially invented the.
Yeah, but we were like, the R must still be rifle, and that's not true.
No.
Yeah,
just R.
But the same emailer also he wasn't doing the being a pedant thing. He was just warning us that people wanting to push back against our discussion might do that. And in fact, wanted to know if that was a logical fallacy. And the short answer is, yeah, sure. It's a informal logical fallacy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really have a name. We've been calling it over at Science-Based Medicine. Actually, I think David Gorski coined this term over there, weaponized pedantry.
Yeah. Right?
Where you basically take tiny errors that don't affect the actual point that you were making, but like a jargon error or a word error or whatever.
Right. Your whole thing is wrong because you misused it.
Exactly.
That.
You use that to discredit the whole argument rather even when it was inconsequential to the argument itself. So, you know, also people use that as sort of like a ad hominem attack to say, well, you don't know what you're talking about because you made this error. Now, as skeptics, we have to be careful not to do that. Sometimes people do make mistakes, and it is you know, if it is inconsequential, and I wouldn't use that to dismiss their actual substance of their argument. But sometimes people make errors that reveal that they don't, that they have a huge conceptual misunderstanding, which does affect their actual argument. That's different. That's not being pedantic. That's, you know, making an important distinction. And that just requires judgment and fairness, right? Just error on the side, I would say, always of what we call steel manning rather than straw manning, whoever you're talking, you're disagreeing with, but of being, you know, fair to the other person.
Use the principle of charity.
Use the principle of charity. Yeah.
Steel man.
Yeah, steel manning is when you go out of your way not to straw man somebody.
I know, that's awesome. I didn't get the memo on that new term. Nobody told me.
but definitely, you know, there are certain cultural groups with belief systems that will do that. Where, you know, like the anti-vaxxers, for example, will do that a lot. And, you know, people who, the gun enthusiasts will often use the weaponized pedantry. Oh, you didn't use the right technical term. Therefore, you don't know guns, and I can dismiss all of your arguments. You don't know.
But you don't have to know anything technical about guns to have an argument about gun regulation.
You don't, but sometimes it does get technical. So it just depends. You know, it depends on how deep you're going on your argument.
It's very different from somebody making an argument about, I don't know, vaccines and lacking the basic biochemistry knowledge, but making a biochemistry argument. Like, we weren't really making, and that's not to dismiss this, because it is important that we be as informed as possible. So I appreciate the emails that inform us. But when we're making arguments about specific types of gun regulations, I suppose when they deal with the technical components of the guns, then it is relevant.
If you're saying that this technical law, which bans this particular modification because it has this effect, it can get technical. So you'll at least
need to understand
what
you're talking
about.
Right, but if we're saying raise the age limits or do a background check, that has nothing to do with technical components of guns.
I agree, exactly. Yeah. But we were sort of mixing both of those. Right. But here's the thing, is that it's very hard to make your arguments and your discussions bulletproof against dedicated weaponized pedantry. It's like almost impossible. If somebody wants to find something wrong with what you said, they will find it. But you should at least make it difficult for them, right? By knowing the topic enough that you're not going to make at least common or simple mistakes, which is usually why, like, before I get into a new area, I try to read enough about it that I'm not going to make those kind of mistakes. But it still happens. You know, every journalist, every writer, whatever, even every scientist publishing a peer-reviewed paper, you make mistakes. That's just, you can't eliminate it to zero. You just have to do the best you can.
That's why it blows my mind, Steve, that some of the emails that we got were literally people being like, where's the evidence? And it's like, wait, I just did such a deep dive into what evidence does exist, and here it is.
So, so that was the other. So one of the kinds of feedback we often get when we talk about gun safety regulations is the weaponized pedantry, or warning us about the weaponized pedantry. But the other kind we get, and we got a couple of these, is the "you guys are biased, I'm not listening to you anymore," or whatever. Or one person even said, "I could give you a detailed description of your errors, but I'm not going to bother to do that. I'm just going to give you this vague general feedback about how you were misinformed or biased or whatever." And so I always respond to those emails by saying, "Hey, we make mistakes. If anything we said is factually incorrect, we will make any appropriate corrections," which we always do, right? We make corrections in the show. Tell us what we did wrong. We'll look into it. If we need to make a correction, we'll do that. Like I just did about assault rifle versus assault weapon. But almost always the response to that is crickets, because if they had specific factual criticisms, they would have said them up front. Yeah. So it's just worthless feedback. It's just worthless to say, you know, give us vague generalities without any specific details to back it up. There's nothing we could do with that. But it's very telling when I then ask for it and don't get any specific ones. And then the third category were, you know, again, this is my characterization, people who argue like gun regulation denialists, right? They're essentially, they're starting with the conclusion that no gun regulations are good. They don't work. They trample freedoms. They're bad. and they're against any regulation, and they argue to justify that position, no matter which pure motivated reasoning. I mean, and I, you know, it, because I know that we're going to be talking about it on the show, I was happy to engage with people who, even if they were, if they were giving me what, you know, pure motivated reasoning, in my opinion. And I'm, again, I'm always trying to give them their best chance, give them their best argument, try to understand what they're saying. Sometimes people have legitimate points to make. This is a genuinely complicated area, in my opinion. And we do want to do regulations that are not cosmetic or feel good or knee jerk. We want to do things that actually move the needle, that actually save lives. That's the goal. And there's been a lot of wishy-washy, vague, poorly crafted, you know, regulations in the past. We don't want to do that either. We want to do things that are, make technical sense, are going to actually have an effect, that are fair, et cetera, et cetera. But I got to tell you, at least the feedback I've had so far was remarkably unimpressive. I mean, like, there was those who were like really, really, like, not engaging in a real conversation, but just pushing back against any regulation, did not do a good job of defending that position. I think because you can't do a good job of defending that position.
Right. But it felt very sacred cow.
Oh,
it
totally.
Felt very much like you're touching on something that's a raw nerve, and I'm going to respond emotionally. I think, Steve, remind me, I feel like we got some feedback about one where they were making the argument that, like, why are you talking about hunting? Because if you look at a reading of the Second Amendment, and I'm like, didn't we address that, like, in a really major way?
We did, but one of the arguments that was, you know, completely unconvincing was the notion of, you're saying that these guns are like good for killing people, but they're not necessarily the best guns for doing that.
Yeah.
They would be better guns that they would use. That's like the powerful argument. Like, well, there are more powerful guns, so these aren't quote unquote powerful guns. It's like, yeah, but that misses the point. We're not saying, it doesn't matter if these are military or civilian guns. It doesn't matter if they're hunting or not hunting guns, or if they're how relatively powerful they are.
Human lethality.
What is the lethality in a situation where you're trying to kill as many people as possible? That's what we want to know, right? That's like the key thing. Mm-hmm. And the more lethal these weapons are, then the more careful
damage
we should be
yeah.
about whose hands they fall into. That, yeah, that's really...
That's not unreasonable. What
most people are saying, like, yeah. in terms of, like, what regulations are being proposed. It's like background checks and licensure and safety training and safe storage and things like that. Raising the age appropriate to the, you know, the how lethal these weapons are, et cetera. It's hard to really, I think, meaningfully push back on this. And then what the final position that the real anti-regulation emailers got to was that they would not tolerate any infringement on gun ownership, no matter how slight it was. That it was any regulation, any even minor inconvenience was completely intolerable.
Wow, absolutists. Huh?
Yeah, so they, essentially...
But that's not even an absolutist, because the Second Amendment, the first four words are a well-regulated militia.
Yeah.
Well, but, yeah, but no, I'm not even saying in that context, in their own thought, in their own heads. they've gone to a place that doesn't really exist.
It's like a fundamentalist, absolutist bastardization of the actual law.
It, not only that, it really just completely ignores, I think, just because they're not aware of it, the ethics and the ethics of government regulations on personal freedoms. So, first of all, just to very quickly summarize, for example, no freedoms are absolute. Freedoms can often come with liabilities and responsibilities and limitations. This is generally recognized legal ethical principles. So, for example, you get to own and drive a car, but you have to get licensed. There are speed limits. There are safety laws which regulate the seatbelt laws and helmet laws for open vehicles
and
airbags for manufacturers.
Yep.
They have to be safety tested. If you have a kid in the car, you have to have a child safety seat, et cetera, et cetera. So there's lots of regulations around driving designed to make it safer, reduce the number of people who die on the roads. And the government has a compelling interest in making the roads safer and in protecting lives. And then you also have to consider, and this is, again, this is just legal precedent. This is standard sort of legal thinking. Is the infringement on personal freedom in proportion to the government's compelling interest to whatever that is, you know, say, for example, save lives.
Right, to protect the larger public. Or
if
whatever.
It's a minor inconvenience that could reduce the number of kids shot to pieces in their school, that's probably proportional, right? But you can't say that no inconvenience is worth it, no matter how beneficial the outcome might be. That does not accord with standard legal reasoning. It just doesn't, or ethical reasoning. And so you can't just unilaterally decide that you're going to change all of legal precedent, you know, because that's the way you want it to be. Right. And we recognize that, private citizens don't get to own fully automatic weapons. They don't get to own howitzers or drive tanks around or have nuclear weapons or rocket launchers. Like there's whole classes of weapons that we say, private citizens have no business owning this. They have no, and restricting their freedom to own these kinds of weapons is a compelling interest of the government and makes for a safer society that we all want. Now, the only real question is, where and how do we draw these lines? That's the only question. And really what we were talking about last week is, if we review the evidence, there is good evidence that there are some very common sense, moderate gun regulations that, you know, that move those lines a little bit and can dramatically reduce the lethality of, you know, of gun, total number of gun deaths in this country, which is
You only focused on the low hanging fruit.
Yeah, really, really. But which is way out of proportion to pretty much any other, Western industrialized democracy. And so the idea that, one guy even said that it's the American culture. It's not guns. It's like, actually, it's been pretty well established that it's the guns, right? It's the availability of the guns. That's what it is. There's nothing else different about America that would really explain why we're so much of an outlier in terms of gun deaths.
Yeah, the only real thing that you could say about our culture that I think is a valid argument is it's our unwillingness to give up the guns, you know? It's our cultural obsession with being armed.
But other countries had similar culture. Australia had a pretty vigorous gun culture as well.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, they were willing to institute regulation and we're not.
But there was a unique kind of political perfect storm around that time that allowed that to happen. Mm-hmm. They had the same kind of pushback. But anyway, the laws went through and it had a dramatic effect on reducing gun violence.
And then they couldn't deny
shootings.
It anymore.
And then it became undeniable. Yeah. In any case, we're happy to continue this conversation. It is a conversation. And it's a good exercise on thinking critically and looking at evidence and taking a step back from your biases and your culture, et cetera. We're trying to be as objective as we can and just talk about the evidence and logic and critical thinking. But if you're going to email us, you're not going to do anyone a favor, and you're just going to make your own side look bad if you just make vague statements, and without saying anything, giving detailed factual discussion, which is what we're interested in. All right, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is science misconceptions. So these are all things that a lot of people think are scientific facts, but they're not.
Oh,
so,
crap,
but just so it's not to get confused, you're still just deciding if the sentence as written is true or not, right?
Right. We're still trying to find the one fiction.
Yes.
Right.
One of these is as written is wrong. The other two are as written correct. Exactly. Even though they're debunking misconceptions.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Double negative here. Okay.
Yeah. Double layer.
All right. Here we go. Item number one. CO2 is not the greatest cause of recent global warming, but rather shorter-lived molecules such as methane. Item number two. Most of the energy generated by the sun is not caused by the fusion of hydrogen into helium. And item number three, the heating up of a spacecraft as it re-enters and descends through the atmosphere is not mostly caused by friction, which is only responsible for a small amount of heat, less than 5%. Before we start, let me just say about number one, because there's a, I just want to just head off a misunderstanding that is very possible. When I say the cause of global warming, I'm talking about what's driving the increase in temperature. Again, somebody could say, well, water vapor causes more heating than the other gases, but water vapor doesn't cause the global warming. Global warming causes increased water vapor. Right.
It's like you're saying, specifically talking about human caused global warming, right? Like anthropogenic.
Well, I said recent. So that's,
you said recent.
What's happening now? It's like similar. If you saying water vapor would be saying like, well, the sun's actually causing the heating. It's like, yeah, but that's, it's not causing the change of the climate that we are calling global warming. Just to be clear, I'm not trying to trick you with that. All right, Jay, go first.
All right. The first one here about CO2 is not the greatest cause of recent global warming. You're saying it's these shorter-lived molecules like methane. Well, I know methane can trap heat better than CO2. This is a tricky one because, you know, there's a lot more CO2 in the atmosphere than methane. So I don't know, man. This one right out of the gate, I think this one might be the fiction because I just don't think that it's these other molecules. I think CO2 is the main cause of it. But let me go on to the other two real quick. Most of the energy generated by the sun is not caused by fusion of hydrogen into helium. Again, these are tricky, Steve, because when you say most of the energy generated by the sun, we're talking about the heat energy, and that is happening by the gravity that is therefore fusing hydrogen into helium. There's so many different little ways to look at that I could see.
Yeah, but again, I'm not trying to trick you. This is not like, oh, it's actually the gravity causing the fusion. I'm not going to do any word game with you. This is saying the heat that the sun is generating, most of that energy is not coming from hydrogen fusing into helium.
Regardless of how that happens. And we're trying to decide if that's true or false.
As written, is the statement right. True or false?
Yeah. And only one of these statements as written is false.
Correct.
I know. It's weird.
Yeah. And then this last one, the heating up of a spacecraft as it reenters and descends through the atmosphere it's not caused by friction. Well, what the hell would it be caused by? If it's not friction of the air on the surface of the spacecraft, wow, Steve, this is, I should be standing up and applauding you because this is so unbelievably hard. All of these seem false to me.
I've been percolating this one for a while. Like there's sometimes where I just keep things in my folder. Eventually I build up enough of them that it makes sense.
Can you share that file, Steve?
All right, this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to say that the second one about the fusion and sun, I'm going to say, yeah, okay, it's most likely that there is another mechanism going on in there that most people don't know about. Fine. I'll swap that one. I'll swipe it right off the list. So now we're between the CO2 as not being the primary cause of global warming, and then we have friction as only being less than 5% of what causes heat. I can't possibly think of any other thing that would be – would cause a re-entering spacecraft to heat up other than friction with the atmosphere. Let me read these words very carefully. Of a spacecraft as it re-enters and descends through the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. He used the word atmosphere. Is not mostly caused by friction, which is, that one has got to be the fake.
Okay, that one's a fiction?
I believe so.
All right, Kara.
I think the sun is a massive fusion reactor. I think that's what I've always known. Is there something else? Is it that it's not hydrogen to helium? But oh, that is it. It's hydrogen to helium. I think that this is like a fundamental of physics. Like, I'm so confused as how this one could be the fiction. But also the CO2, like the one that I'm willing to give is the one that Jay picked as the fiction. So I'm feeling really differently. Like, maybe it's not technically friction. Maybe, like, yes, and I know you can have friction in air because air has it flows, right? It's still fluid dynamics, but maybe it's doing something other than like just the surface. Maybe there's like an air gap or there's something happening between, and I don't know. These are really high speeds, so it's weird stuff. Maybe it's superheating because of something else. The hydrogen to helium one is killing me, but also CO2 is not the greatest cause of recent global warming, but rather shorter-lived molecules such as methane. This is a common misunderstanding.
Double,
right?
Wow.
Like, I feel like a lot of people go, oh, it's cow farts. And you're like, yeah. So methane is more concentrated. And so per molecule, methane released into the atmosphere causes more global warming. But there's way more CO2 being put out into the atmosphere than methane.
Yeah.
Like, methane leaks are bad. They're worse than CO2 leaks. But when you, it's still a net CO2 majority, is what I thought. But I also thought that the sun is a big fusion reactor, hydrogen to helium. And then I think more stuff happens down the line. Oh, maybe that's the trick. Maybe that's only the start of the reaction. And when we talk about, I mean, this could be so misinterpreted, Steve. I don't know if I'm trying to, if I'm getting too weird here, but it starts with hydrogen to helium. And then, of course, more and more molecules are produced. And maybe it's the later down the chain molecules that actually are the most energy.
I think I'm wrong.
Ugh. I think it's the CO2 one that's the... Wait, oh, we're supposed to pick the one that's the fiction.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, only if you want to win.
So yeah, I think this the spacecraft, it's not mostly caused by friction. I think that, I mean, I could be wrong here, but I think that maybe most of the energy generated by the sun is not actually the fusion of hydrogen to helium, but a later downchain fusion reaction. And that CO2 is the greatest cause of recent global warming, not methane.
Okay, Bob.
Oh, Bob, you should know this. Please debunk what I just said.
Did everybody go?
Nope.
No, Evan, Evan hasn't gone yet.
Go, Bob.
God, I got to try not to metagame. Why did Steve pick me third?
I just try to mix it up, Bob. I'm not
sure. Sure, Steve.
There's a method to your random insanity.
I'm just going to, I'll just say that the sun produces most of its energy, I think, by far, by fusing hydrogen into helium.
Whoa.
So I'm just going to flat out say that that's wrong. I can't think of one subtlety that I might be missing.
You don't mean that's wrong then. You mean that's right.
Most of the energy generated by the sun is not caused by fusion.
Oh.
But that's incorrect. Yeah. I think that's incorrect. I mean, I'm just trying to think what I could be missing. I mean, it could be, you know, is it helium being fused afterwards? But there, I think it's still a shit ton of hydrogen fusion is happening. Something about the corona. We know the corona is, you know, the hottest, you know, the hotter than the surface. Could that be involved? Could it be the release of magnetic energy at the surface? Because that releases a shit ton of energy when the magnetic fields break out. But no, I don't think any of that's beating the fusion. I mean, it's straightforward fiction.
So why do you think the other true?
Doesn't matter. Evan,
no, go ahead, Kara. Steve, don't interrupt
Evan,
Kara.
They're all spread out, so no help to you. Who are you going to believe?
All right. Well, real quick, Bob, you hit on what I was thinking about on why the energy generated by the sun is not caused by the fusion. I was thinking perhaps the magnetic energy is greater. So I think it's going to come down to which energies are we talking about here. Yet you're still going with that one as the fiction, yeah. Which surprises me a little bit. And Kara, you had some interesting thoughts also about the heavier elements that wind up getting created sort of along the way. So that was interesting too. Jay, I can't think of a reason why though the spacecraft, you know, other than friction, unless it's the excitement of the heating of the material itself is a higher energy state. Therefore, those atoms are moving much, much, much faster. Is friction doing that, or is some what would be the other catalyst for that if not friction? Yikes, that's a tough one. And then the CO2 one, yeah, methane. You know, the trick here, I think, is the recent global warming one, because haven't CO2 levels in some ways maybe it was once the greatest cause of recent global warming, but since actions have been taken to try to reduce it, it's maybe no longer that. It depends how you're measuring the things. I don't know how to measure the abundance of CO2 versus the abundance of methane and make that kind of comparison. That one is sitting with me, I think, the least comfortably. So I'm going to join Kara and say that the CO2 one is the fiction.
So let me throw out what I didn't want to say, and that was that the number three, the friction. I mean, it is well known that, well, by, I don't know, not well known, but I do know that meteorites are heated not by friction. They're heated by the compression, not by the friction. You could have a cold meteorite on the ground. It's the compression that heats it up and causes all that fiery goodness.
But Bob, what do you know that I don't know about number one?
All right.
I just, you know.
So let's start with three, since Bob's so eager to talk about that one. The heating up of a spacecraft as it re-enters and descends through the atmosphere is not mostly caused by friction, which is only responsible for a small amount of heat, less than 5%. Jay, our Apollo aficionado on the podcast, thinks this one is the fiction.
I would like to say I no longer think it's the fiction.
Everyone else thinks this one is science.
I've done that too, Jay.
And this one is science. Yes, Bob is correct. It is produced by the compression of the air in front of the craft, not caused by friction. And that process is called what, Bob?
Compression.
It's the adiabatic process.
Oh, my God.
Oh, that's right.
Adiabatic process.
I knew that.
Thermodynamics.
I knew it.
Essentially, one of the ways this happens is if you compress air, but so that you have the same number of molecules of air in a smaller area, smaller volume, it heats up proportionally. So it heats up as exponentially, essentially. So, that air as it's so massively compressed by the ship, the heat shield moving through the atmosphere, that is what causes the vast majority of the heat. The actual friction is a very small amount of heat. So it's mainly the craft itself is heating up through radiative heating from the hot compressed gas that it's creating as it moves through the atmosphere. Very cool. But again, that is one of those ones, like we all hear, it's friction as it's moving through the atmosphere, right? It's moving through so fast. But that is not correct.
All right,
let's go back to the second one. Most of the energy generated by the sun is not caused by the fusion of hydrogen into helium. Bob, you alone think this one is the fiction. And this one is science.
You're fucking kidding, man.
I know, right? When I read this, I'm like, this is so going to be a science or fiction.
No, that's not what you thought, Steve. When you read that, you said, I'm totally going to screw Bob over with this one. That's what you were thinking. Explain it. Is it magnetic release?
No. It is because of fusion happening in the core. Kara was close, but it's not heavier elements that are producing all the energy. That doesn't happen until, you get helium built up in the core and then to the point where, you can't sustain fusion of hydrogen anymore. And then the star collapses until the core heats up enough to then start fusing the helium. And that keeps happening depending on the total mass of the sun, of the star. Our sun right now is burning hydrogen, right?
Right.
Okay.
But it's not that it's not what happens after it becomes helium. It's what happens before it becomes helium.
What are you talking about?
I'm telling you what I'm talking
that
about.
That's the fusion. That's part of the fusion process.
Fusing hydrogen into helium. The energy comes from hydrogen fusing into other forms of hydrogen. It eventually does fuse into helium, but that's not where most of the energy comes from. Energy comes from other fusion reactions that cause deuterium and whatever. So it's just changing the number of the isotope of the hydrogen. That's what generates most of the energy. It's not the actual fusing of hydrogen into helium. That does produce energy, but just not the most energy. That's the minority of the energy.
Yeah.
Whoa. Isn't that interesting?
You suck.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
It will be tomorrow, not right now.
So here are the processes. Two protons, hydrogen one, fuse together, producing
proton, right?
And another particle plus energy. Deuterium and a proton fuse to produce helium-3 and energy. Two helium-3 nuclei fuse together, producing helium-4, two protons and energy. Helium-3 fuses with helium-4, producing beryllium. This is a minor thing. So the only thing in there, which is hydrogen fusing into helium, is the second step, and that produces the minority of the total energy produced by the total process. So that's why it's wrong. Great.
When did we find that
question.
Out? I mean, have we known that a long time?
Yeah, totally. This is just something.
Okay. It's just really specific.
Yeah.
So you start with hydrogen, and you end up with helium and a lot of energy.
And that's
wrong. The steps along the way is apparently.
So all the steps along the way that are producing most of the energy. All of this means that CO2 is not the greatest cause of recent global warming, but rather short-lived molecules such as methane is the fiction because that's not true.
Because, well.
Yeah. So what percentage of global warming is caused by carbon dioxide?
Who cares?
I think most of it, like 70, 80%.
80%. Right? 80%.
Yeah, that's
a lot. I was right, Steve. That was my first pick.
It is the CO2.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah, Jay, we're going to go for that. Right?
But these were all meant to get you. These were all meant to get you.
Let's just end the show, please.
I know, Bob. Don't you just want to punch yourself right in the balls?
I have failed myself.
This one was really hard, Steve.
It was so hard. It pisses me off because I made an argument for all of them in my head, but my gut told me it was the first one. And then I didn't
listen to yourself.
The reason it was the hardest for me is the reason sometimes science or fiction really gets me. Like, I get weirdly meta, and I'm like, wait, am I looking for the one that's not right?
Yeah.
I get so confused.
Don't confuse yourself.
Yeah.
It's always the same. Is it true or not as written, right? That's.
But when you add the word not, yes. I get very confused.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Science is a search for basic truths about the universe, a search which develops statements that appear to describe how the universe works, but which are subject to correction, revision, adjustment, or even outright rejection upon the presentation of better or conflicting evidence. James Randi. Miss him.
James.
Aww. Miss him.
Yeah. Miss him. Yep.
Yep. I like bringing him up every once in a while. Still good memories, great memories. So kind. Oh, yeah. So generous.
Yep. I feel so lucky that we got to know him.
Yeah, that was one of the best aspects of, you know, being skeptical activists is the cool people that we met, and James Randi definitely is among them.
Oh, yes.
A giant in the skeptical movement. Absolutely. All right, everyone. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
It takes
four hydrogen atoms to fuse into each helium atom. During the process, some of the mass is converted into energy.
Bob, don't fight it.
Just go with
it. Don't fight it,
Bob. Just calm down. Walk away slowly. Don't let this ruin the rest of your night or week.
I'm just saying I was partly right, at least.
I had the right answer. I was on top of the right answer, and then I got sidetracked by a lark.
But isn't that also such a college professor thing to do? Like, okay, that might have been right, but this other one was more right.
That's an SAT question, right? Sort of.
Oh, Bob. Bob, you were technically wrong, which is the best kind of
right. Kind of wrong.
Don't use that quote on me, you bastard.
All right. Well.
Best guess.
Until next week. This is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.